Heavy slugs from the three facing machine gun posts continue to whipsaw the gorge bottom, chewing rock and flesh alike. Bezoar and Crad squatted in bloody water up to their waists, pinned down by the fusillade. The elder swineherd shivered uncontrollably from the cold and from shock, but his friend seemed inured to both. Dense layers of body fat and a cross-wired bully brain protected Crad from the totality of the horror and the proximity of death. Corpses caked in mud made of sandy dirt mixed with gore lay all around them. More dead floated face down in the destroyed interstate's seep pools. Under hellacious fire, the wounded crawled across open ground to reach the cover of shallow ditches and piles of concrete, some dragging 20-foot-long tails of uncoiled entrails behind them. Some of the sacrificial lambs continued to return fire from behind the larger chunks of concrete. Holding their weapons by the pistol grips, they reached high over their heads. Sticking the muzzles over the tops of blocks of the shattered roadway, they cut loose unaimed bursts in the general direction of the ridge. Ferdinando scampered up and down the firing line, jumping from ditch to ditch and mound to mound, carefully doling out a limited supply of full magazines. It was plenty light enough for Haldane's gunners to see the movement, and for them to track it. The one-armed man hopped behind a tabletop of up-tilted pre-dark roadbed. Then, cut off as if by a switch, the machine gun on the western gate stopped firing. Control of the gorge, and of the access routes in and out of the ville, depended on three fully operational blaster positions. One at each of the gates at either end, one in the middle. The gun post on the eastern gate could only bring its sights to bear on the edge of Malasha's attack force, which left the emplacement amidships on the berm with the job of pinning them down. A job it couldn't handle. Without multiple lines of crossfire, it was impossible to contain the attacking force and to prevent them from taking the western gate. Malash swung back onto his horse.
We have them now! Come on!
The Bill's middle M60 tried to hit him, but it couldn't, even with daylight fast upon them. Despite himself, Bezoar was stirred by the sight of the black mask impaler, fanned by hundreds of slugs, but riding on unharmed. Those with functioning weapons, those whose courage hadn't been broken, jumped from cover and ran after him.
The west gate is falling! Get your asses up! Get moving!
The remaining troops did not obey. If anything, they all crouched lower. The leader of the cannon fodder held an AK in his crippled hand. It wasn't so crippled that he couldn't pull a trigger. Ferdinando fired over the heads of the cowering conscripties.
Die here or die there! Get the fuck up!
Everyone who was still able roused him or herself, crawling out of the puddles and trenches, slipping out from behind mounds of dirt. Crad helped Bezoar from the water, then retrieved his floating crutch and half-carried him over the demolished ground. As he hobbled along, Bezoar saw a child curled up in a narrow space under a slab of concrete. The boy couldn't have been more than 9. He was alive. Their eyes met, but Bezoar said nothing. He looked away from the mirror of his own mortal fear. The boy wasn't the only one hiding in the blown-up section of highway. Other young children concealed themselves in small dark places, hoping to turn invisible until the battle was done. The going was faster once they reached the turnoff and the more or less intact roadway.
Stop us together! You make easier targets that way!
Bezoar looked up at the hill. The pitched battle for Sunspot ground on and on. He was certain that he was going to die this day. Although heavy machine gun fire still laced the air, none of the fodder bothered to duck their heads anymore. Ducking every few seconds didn't do any good, it just slowed you down. By the time you ducked, the slugs were already either past you or through you. The farther they got from the blown-up section of highway, the less effective the machine gun fire from the middle of the berm became. The kill zone was way too wide for one gun to saturate with bullets. The best he could do was harass. Far ahead of the ragged company, Baron Malash raced across the four-lane road, his horse's hooves striking sparks on the road metal. The woman right in front of Bezoar staggered as the back of her head exploded in a puff of red. He and Crad were pelted by pieces of her skull with long strands of hair attached. Her upper body bent at the waist, leaning forward until her chin lay on the ground. When they reached the bottom of the path, the middle machine gun could no longer turn far enough to hit them. They advanced up the grade. Above the fodder, on the path, the Black Rider galloped full speed toward Sunspot's western gate. The Impaler had an AK-47 in either hand. Neither hand felt the reins. Controlling the warhorse with knee and boot pressure on its sides, Alash rode straight for the double gates. The larger of the two was meant for Wags. The sight of a semi-trailer blocked that opening. The foot traffic gate consisted of a half-buried yellow school bus. If the gate guards had had an escape plan before the attack, it was out the window now. And they knew that Milosh never took prisoners. It was either hold off the fodder or die. Milosh dug his heels into the horse's sides, making it suddenly veer to the right. He rode for the school bus and the two shooters. Because the Baron was on horseback, and therefore elevated above the ground by at least 10 feet, he could angle his fire over the end of the engine block. In truth, the school bus sentries had no more protection than he did. Milosh raised both pre-dark assault rifles. Controlling the muzzle climb single-handed, he peppered the hood, fenders, and grill. The rounds he sent through the open front windshield drove the sentries to their knees, forcing them to stop shooting back. Sensing their own impending doom, two Haldane guards broke and ran, heading for the open rear doors of the bus. But before they reached them, the Baron closed the gap. As the Stallion skidded to a stop in front of the bumper, Milosh emptied the AKs through the windshield from behind. While Bezoar and the 50 or so other survivors of the gorge hurried up the path to join him, Milosh dismounted and tethered his horse to the bus's bumper. The battle inside the berm was intensifying as the fodder reached the Baron. Torrents of gunfire poured from under the semi-trailer. Most of it was aimed into, not out of the berm. A half-dozen Haldane fighters scrambled out from under the wag gate, driven from the bill by Milosh shooters on the inside. Though they all held weapons, they didn't use them. They were out of ammo. Confronted by the Baron and his fodder at the head of the path, they threw their guns down at once. Right off the bat, and without a direct order, some of the cannon fodder cut loose with their battered assault rifles.
Save your bullets! Use your blades and gun butts on the ones without blasters!
The fodder showed no mercy to their adversaries. No doubt some were thinking about friends who had been left on the ground in the gorge as they attacked the outnumbered troopers.
Enough of that shit! We have a town to take!
With Milosh in the lead, the cannon fodder scurried under the belly of the Waggate semi-trailer, entering Sunspot. When Bezoar stuck his head around one of the flattened front tires, his jaw dropped. Sunspot was an even worse shit pile than Wolfbone. The only dwellings were a bunch of wrecked wags and trailers lined up in a pounded dirt field. It wasn't a place worth dying for, but already more than 100 people had done just that. There were bodies strewn everywhere, and it was impossible to tell which side they had been on. And the fight wasn't over. The remaining Haldane defenders were disappearing into the entrance of a pre-dark concrete block building, there to make their last stand. Just before the dawn, Baron Haldane had pricked up his ears. He strained to precisely locate the source of the soft noises, but he couldn't. It was still too dark to see anything moving. He prayed that the noise was Bollinger returning from Sunspot with the full garrison on his heels. Haldane's Sekhman Kuzo pulled a rebuilt pair of pre-dark infrared goggles down over his eyes and carefully scanned the surrounding darkness.
Whatever the hell it is, it sure ain't Bollinger. I can't see nothing out there. Not a rad blasted thing.
Something's sneaking around, though. Maybe it's rattlesnakes.
There'd have to be an army of them to make that much noise, Bertram.
And they'd be crawling through the camp for sure. Looking for heat or meat.
Where the hell is Bollinger? That bastard should have been back here 4 hours ago.
As the interminable, awful night had worn on, and Bollinger had failed to show up with the garrison's troops, Haldane had grown more and more concerned. There had been no sounds of gunfire, though, which meant that Milosh's army hadn't intercepted Bollinger and the others on their way to the ville. If they'd been attacked en route, they would have gotten off at least a few shots. If they'd been attacked on the way back, more than a few shots would have been exchanged. It was just starting to get light.
Damn it to hell!
Haldane recognized his own M60s opening up. If his garrison had already been evacuated, Milosh would have taken the ville without a struggle. Bollinger and the others hadn't made it there, and they weren't going to make it back.
Our guys are in for it.
Maybe they can hold them off.
Our gunposts are pouring fire into the gorge. Milosh is getting the shit kicked out of him.
Soon they saw a signal flare burst high over the ville. The red star slowly floated down and disappeared behind the berm walls.
Shit.
Baron Milosh has got something nasty up his sleeve. You can bet on that.
The gorge assault was a feint. The main attack is coming from the north.
A bright flash bloomed in the sky above the ridge, backlighting the berm before winking out.
The bastards just blew the berm. There's nothing stopping them now. It's gonna be a bloodbath.
We should be up there with our people, damn it.
Haldane looked over his shoulder at the shadowy Lyagushka artillery piece. It stood ready in the middle of the circle of wags, waiting for the warm-up act to end and the main event to commence. Magus's gunner had done his preliminary calculations the previous evening. He determined the distance to target and the necessary powder charge. He tilted the barrel up for a high arc lob that would drop the warheads over the wall and into Sunspot's midst. The Lyagushka was already loaded with a D-462 smoke round. More D-462 rounds and propellant charges were stacked on the left side of the gun. The chem projectiles were separately stacked on the right. To mark the impact of the smoke rounds and pinpoint the target for the sarin projectiles, the gunner had to wait until daylight, which was only 10 minutes or so away. The Baron realized that probably he would never learn what had gone wrong the previous night. Bottom line, one way or another, was that his entire garrison was going to die. Haldane wouldn't have enough men to overwhelm Magus's road trash and rescue Thorn. It was the worst of all possible outcomes. Haldane felt a crushing sadness. He knew his soldiers in Sunspot would fight to the death. They could expect no mercy from Baron Malash. Haldane had failed them. He had failed their families. He should have pulled the garrison out earlier. Victory, if and when it came, was going to be hollow, and it was going to taste of ashes. At that moment, it occurred to him that Magus himself might have had something to do with Bollinger's failure to safely reach Sunspot. Steel Eyes could have easily sent a few of his own men out to waylay and kill the warning team. By making sure the garrison didn't escape the Ville, Magus could extract the most suffering and pain from the circumstances under his control. By playing his cards right, he could get rid of Malash and Haldane and most of their standing armies in one fell swoop. He wouldn't need to use chem weapons against Nuevaville then. He could lurch in and take over the entire barony, or loot it and burn it to the ground.
Are you okay, Baron? Because you don't look okay.
We're in a bad spot.
You can't blame yourself for what's happening up in Sunspot. You tried your best to get our troops out. It was up to Bollinger, and he blew the mission.
Our guys might still turn Malash back, drive him out of the Ville.
And if they don't, there's nothing you could have done about it. Malash still would have broken through the berm. You know he's going to chill all our people. He never leaves survivors.
I'm not going to give up my son to Magus. I've got to save him. Without reinforcements from the Ville, that's going to be a lot harder.
Kuzo and Bertram and the other 5 sec men exchanged grim looks. They knew they were going to have a lopsided fight on their hands.
We'll do whatever you tell us, Baron.
No way we're going to let that clank of bag of bolts hurt your boy.
I know you won't. I better go check on Thorn.
Haldane turned away from his sec men and walked along the perimeter of the circled wags. 150 feet farther on, next to the landship, a high-backed captain's chair had been set out on the desert hardpan, facing the battle that raged on the ridge. It was light enough now to see what was sitting in it. As the Baron approached Magus's throne chair, a pair of road trash stepped forward, blocking his path, and taking aim at his chest with their spanking new H&K machine pistols.
No, no. It's all right. I have nothing to fear from Baron Haldane, do I?
The question was addressed to Haldane. If he said no, it was an admission of defeat. He chose not to answer it.
From the fireworks up there, it looks like Malash is getting the upper hand. Little does he know that it will be his final victory. Everything is working out exactly as planned.
Haldane wondered what Steel Eye's plan really was, and how he fit into it. Eventually he would find out, with luck, before it was too late.
You're getting a bargain, I hope you know. This is all working out so perfectly, I should have charged you more for my services. Maybe triple. But a deal is a deal.
What are you getting out of this? You don't need the jack.
Everyone is measured in this life by their deeds.
Your deeds are already well known throughout Deathlands.
That's true enough. Then let's say I possess a certain technology and an overwhelming desire to see it put into action. What good is the power to destroy if it is never exercised? Empty threats do not accomplish anything. Resolve must be shown. Besides, I feel morally compelled to help my friends and punish my enemies. I hope you are not starting to regret the bargain we've made. It is a great pity that your troops didn't make it out before Malash arrived. But there's no turning back now.
Like you said, the deal is done. No turning back. Now, I'm gonna see how my son is doing, if you don't mind.
Why would I mind? Remember, don't cross the line. If you do, well, you know what will happen.
Magus showed the Baron his right hand. Clutched in the half-human fingers was a dark object, the shape of a playing card, but about a quarter inch thick. The remote detonator. Visible in the early morning light, out on the flatland, maybe 80 yards from the captain's chair, was a beige box with a handle on top. There were no doors, no locks between the buoyant rescue. Just a small electronic device and a wad of gray plastic explosive. When Haldane got closer to the beige box, he could see a curved line scratched in the dirt. On Magus's orders, a crude 20-foot diameter circle had been drawn around the pet carrier. Inside the perimeter was no man's land. If he stepped onto it, Magus would detonate the explosive, perhaps killing both father and son. Most certainly killing son. The booby-trapped cage was far enough from the camp so the blast wouldn't injure Magus, his wags, or his men. The Baron rounded the curve of the circle until he faced the metal-barred door. He couldn't see inside the cramped box.
Thorn! Son!
Dad?
I'm here!
I'm cold, Dad!
Before Haldane could turn his head, he caught something moving out of the corner of his eye. He pivoted and swung up the Remington 1100, but whatever it was already gone. Vanished over a hummock in the sand like a shadow cast by a scudding cloud. He had the impression of a blackish body, maybe 2 feet long. Something scooting along close to the ground. His son couldn't have seen it from the cage. Maybe he hadn't either. Maybe he had imagined it.
Everything's gonna be all right, Thorn. You've got to stay strong a little longer.
What's the shooting for?
It's a long way off. It'll be over soon.
Will I get out of here then?
Yes, son. Then we'll go back home to Nuevaville.
I'm scared, Dad.
I won't let anything happen to you. I promise.
Haldane hunkered down on one knee, staring at the cage. If he felt guilt over the deaths of his brave men and the risk to his innocent son, he had few qualms over the fate of the residents of Sunspot. Now they were about to be wiped off the face of the earth. If the people of Sunspot had been better subjects, more loyal to him, more honest, his feelings toward them might have been different. But as things stood, he saw their extermination as good riddance. There was no doubt about it. Haldane's forces were losing the battle. Magus planned to wait until the shooting stopped before he launched the gas attack. By that time, every member of the garrison would have been killed. It never occurred to the Baron to call off the Saren bombardment. If he had done so, his troops would have died in vain, and the Malash problem would have still existed. Everything that the Baron held dear lay in the hands of Magus. The future of his son, the future of his people. And Magus couldn't be trusted. Haldane had a plan, but it was born of desperation. As soon as the gas rounds were away, Magus had to die. As Ryan and Mildred charged the side of the Waggate shoulder, they fired at the defenders crouching behind the wheels and bellying down beneath the undercarriage. Bullets from the SIG and the ZKR sprayed across the double front wheels. As the wheels flattened, that end of the trailer dropped onto its rims. No way could they stop to take more careful aim. They were taking heavy fire from auto rifles positioned at the corners of the welcome center as well. They didn't change course, and they didn't slow down. That would have been suicide. And the blur of surrounding movement was impossible to tell friend from foe. There were 100 simultaneous threats. Ryan and Mildred had on their battle blinders, which reduced the world to a finite goal in tight focus. There was cover and safety under the trailer, if they could drive out the current occupants. Everything they had, they went for it. Two of the Waggate's defenders broke under the pressure. They squirted out from under the front of the trailer and sprinted along the berm in the direction of the welcome center. Ryan and Mildred let them go. They were no longer an immediate threat, and there were still Haldane fighters shooting from under the semi. With his fedora jammed way down on his head and a wild look in his spectacle magnifying eyes, JB came at the trailer from the rear. Having emptied his Uzi, he switched to the M4000 on the run and fired from the hip. His shot pattern spread wide under the trailer, raising clouds of dust. The Haldane fighters hiding behind the wheels to avoid Nobles and Ryan's gunfire couldn't hide from his volleys of number two pellets. Bullets from outside the berm skipped through the Yellow Wag's open rear doors and plowed into the ground. In a hail of lead, a pair of bodies fell halfway out of the school bus, head first, arms hanging down, blood pouring from open mouths. Ryan skidded to a stop beside the trailer's wheel. Ducking, he peered around the ruined tires. Over the sights of the SIG, he saw the last of the Wag guards sprinting away from the trailer and down the path that led to the interstate. In their haste, the Waggate troopers had left empty assault rifles and spent mags on the ground, along with their blood. JB scrambled under the trailer's rear bumper, crawling on all fours, keeping his head low to keep from bumping it on the undercarriage. Mildred scooted in behind Ryan as he moved to the path side of the trailer. One look told him that Milosh had arrived, with cannon fodder intact.
Bastard guards ran.
Not far enough.
Save your bullets! Use your blades and gunfoot! The ones without bastards!
Enough of that shit! We have a town to take!
Ryan and Mildred advanced to the front of the trailer, while JB finished reloading his weapons. On the one-eyed man's signal, they moved out from under the gate, running along the inside of the berm, to the protection of the back end of the school bus. Bullets from the welcome center slammed the opposite side of the bus. It was the only direction fire was coming from. The machine guns had stopped shooting, presumably because the remaining gun posts at the center and east end of the berm had been abandoned. The survivors of Haldane's force had pulled back, retreating to make their stand inside the most solid structure in the build. The cannon fodder spilled out from under the Waggate, red-faced and triumphant from their stomp vest. Behind the first wave, a tall figure in black appeared. Baron Milosh held an AK-47 in either hand.
Spread out!
The bullet sponges crossed the stretch of open ground, limping and hopping for the first row of sunspot shelters. Suddenly, another barrage opened up from the corners of the welcome center. The Impaler reached cover untouched by lead. Not all of his companions were so lucky. Easily one-third of the expendable lay face down in the dirt behind him. Ryan scanned the battlefield. Some of the Hellhounds were running loose in packs. Others were dead, either shot or blown apart by Gren blasts. Milosh's Norm fighters had moved around the other side of the hill, along the edge of the berm, coming at the welcome center through the rows of makeshift shelters. Swampies waited with them at the edge of the shacks. No billfolk were visible. The Impaler and his men led the attack in two prongs, a pincer movement closing in on the welcome center. Haldane fighters shot back from behind the garden's concrete compost bins, trying to protect the retreat of their comrades. Wrens arced through the air, lobbed from behind an immobile Winnebago into the middle of the garden. When the Compty smoke cleared, the rings of leveled foliage revealed corpses sprawled face down between the rows. Some were torn apart. Following up on the frag Wrens, Milosh and his fighters poured concentrated fire on the welcome center, driving the defenders back behind their shooting positions. With no cover between the bus and the center's entryway, Ryan, Mildred, and JB couldn't advance on the target. They held their fire and watched the battle unfold. Backed by the full auto assault, Milosh's Norms rushed for a corner of the garden, firing as they went. Haldane's men abandoned the compost bins, pulling back to the concrete planters. The attackers pressed on, dashing through the garden rows to the just vacated compost bins. From that position, the Impaler's men chucked more Grens, blind-tossing them over the roof and corner of the welcome center. The first couple bounced on the concrete path and rolled away toward the berm, exploding without consequence. The third Gren landed smack in the middle of one of the long concrete planters. The deadly blast triggered the defenders' final retreat. As the last of Haldane's soldiers disappeared inside the doorway, Milosh and his combined forces charged the building. Christy and Jack started ushering the boys down the lane.
They got him!
Behind them, two swampy females ran to the corpse of Meconium and fell to their knees in grief. Jack and Christy turned to look.
Huh. Maybe Meconium de Fada. A brother. Or Fada de Children.
Or all of the above. Thing about swampies is,
they stick together.
The females suddenly whipped a pair of found AK-47s out from under the folds of their loose-waisted, ground-dragging skirts.
They also live for revenge.
Ah! I'm gonna get you for what you've done to him, Snowball!
The Swampy didn't appear to be trained in the art of firing a full-auto weapon. Her next move confirmed that. The muzzle climbed higher and higher with every discharging round. Despite the considerable moorings of her big feet and her massive behind, she went down on her butt. Before she could recover, Jack calmly shot her through the face. Her sister Swampy somehow managed to find her own weapon selector switch. She squinted down the AK's sights. The rifle's recoil jolted her upper body backward. Christy raised her revolver. The Swampy dropped the AK, and holding in her guts with one hand, whipped out a nick-bladed filleting knife with the other.
I'm gonna stitch you with this, and then I'm gonna twist it around!
They die for revenge, too.
We have to keep moving, or we're all gonna get chilled. Is there some safe place we can leave you to?
The boys stared at each other, gravely weighing whether they should give up such an important secret to virtual strangers. In this case, the strangers had saved their lives more than once.
This way.
Christine and Jack followed as they took off up the lane. The boys stopped at a rust-orange cargo container and pushed open a crookedly hanging door, which was nothing more than a rectangle of metal cut from the wall and hinged with concentric loops of baling wire. Inside, the light came from a series of holes hacked high in the back wall and a torch burning in a crude stanchion. The pallets on the floor were jammed edge to edge. There was no telling how many people slept in the enclosure. It smelled of torch smoke and layers of unwashed humanity. A curtain of black plastic covered part of one end of the narrow metal room. The children headed straight for it. Pulling back the plastic, they revealed what looked like an indoor toilet. A three-holer seat made of a wooden plank formed the top of the holding box below. A plastic bucket hanging from the wall was half-filled with corn cobs. The boys gripped either end of the plank seat and started to lift it to one side.
Wait! What are you doing?
It's okay, it's not real.
Jack snatched the torch off the wall. Leaning forward, he sniffed the air above the three-holer.
Not a shitter.
What's down there, then?
It's an entrance to the tunnels.
Tunnels?
Well, they're more like caves, really. They're natural. We didn't dig them out. They run all under the ground of the vill. There must be miles and miles of them all down through the ridge. That's where everybody from the vill is hiding. It's where we always go when the cold hearts come. When the fighting's over, we come out.
You two can come down with us, too. It's okay. You'll be safe there. We can't do that. We're looking for a friend.
And you have found him, my dear.
Jack swept the torch back over the commode. Christy peered down into the crapper and saw a familiar face framed by the center seat hole. His lama in hand, Doc Tanner smiled up at her. Ryan, Mildred, and JB joined the throng storming the windowless flank of the Welcome Center. From the ground to 15 feet up its sides, it was pocked with overlaid bullet craters. The corners of the building had been gnawed into saw teeth by slugs and grens. The bigger holes had been crudely patched with mortar. Inside the berm, fighting had virtually ceased. All of Haldane's other survivors had withdrawn through the Welcome Center's locked and blocked front entrance. Heavy 4x8 steel plates covered the inside of the double entry doors. The facing windows were all blocked as well, either by more steel plates or by plywood baffles. There were no gun ports cut for the defenders to shoot through, perhaps because such ports were used to fire in as well as out. Perhaps because the game plan of Haldane's troopers was to withstand a siege. As there was no immediate threat from the trapped enemy, Baron Milosh let his own fighters have a bit of a rest. The Norm sat in the shade of the building, drinking water, nursing minor wounds and sprains, and attending to their weapons. Some of the Swampies caught and leashed the remaining dogs. Others moved around the compound, robbing valuables and weapons from the dead. During the lull, Ryan, Mildred, and JB looked for their missing companions among the crowd.
Don't see him.
Me neither.
Ryan glanced back at the bodies strewn on the ground, the tendons in his jaws flexing.
Don't go there, Ryan.
Yeah, but maybe they're wounded or trapped. Anything's possible. We've got to search every stinking trailer.
Ryan set off for the nearest row of shacks. His friends had to hurry to keep up.
Where are the vill folk?
Probably under their mattresses, pissing themselves.
The burst of gunfire at their backs made them stop and turn, weapons in hand. Baron Malosh had fired one of his AKs in the air. Now he was pointing both weapons at them.
Where do you think you're going?
We got missing people.
Take another step and you'll be missing too. Nobody leaves the battlefield until I say so. There's still work to do.
Before Ryan could act, the muzzles of Malosh's officers' auto rifles bracketed them.
Fine.
As they walked past him, Baron Malosh turned to his officers.
Blow the plates on the front doors. Use grens. I don't want to destroy the building unless I have to.
What are we going to do about finding Christy, Jack, and Doc?
Can't fight the whole Nukan army. Old Malosh has got his eye on us now. He's not going to let us slip away before he takes a welcome center.
I only see one way out. We have to get the battle won. Once that's done, we can locate Christy and Jack. They've got to be inside the berm. We'll split up and search the place as fast as we can.
What about Doc?
We don't even know if Doc is here. Maybe he never made it this far. If he isn't here, he's out on the interstate somewhere. After we regroup, we'll head out through the west gate and backtrack his route.
And if we don't find him there?
We'll find him.
Take cover!
Officers came barreling out of the Welcome Center entryway. Everyone scurried. The force of the blast surged outward and upward, bringing down the doorway's lintel and a section of the covered walkway. Though flash burned, the steel doors still stood.
Not enough C4, Malosh.
Malosh turned to JB and nodded in agreement, then faced his officers again.
You satchels! Get those doors open!
The men disappeared into the lingering smoke, carrying canvas bags of explosive charges. They reappeared moments later without the charges, running for their lives.
Take cover!
Zigzagging cracks appeared in the lines of concrete blocks. The force of the explosion caved in the building's entrance all the way to the roof, twisting apart the joint of the steel barriers like a giant can opener. If Malosh was unhappy about the collateral damage, his nose-to-chin leather mask kept it hidden.
Clear the rubble! Pull those plates out of the way!
At the direction of their one-armed captain, the oldies and the cripples moved to the piles of tumbled-down and fractured concrete blocks and started moving them to the sides of the ruined entrance. They opened a path to the gap in the plates. The bullets dropped four of the fodder at once, blowing them off their feet and onto their backs on the heaps of broken blocks.
Put on some fire!
Ryan, JB, and Mildred moved ahead with the others, taking up shooting positions behind piles of rubble. The intense incoming fire forced the companions to keep their heads down. Even if they could have raised their heads, they couldn't have seen the shooters. Unable to take aim, companions shot over and around the rubble, laying down random return fire. The other Norms did the same. They put up enough covering fire for one of the officers to reach the protection of the left-hand plate. He primed a gren and chucked it through the gap. Malosh signaled for more grens. The officer chucked in another two.
We got him now! Follow me!
With AKs poised in either hand, he charged through the narrow gap, running low and fast. His officers shoved the Norm fighters after him. Ryan and the others swung in behind them, into the mass of acrid smoke and hot dust. They crouched inside the hallway, weapons up, with nothing to shoot at. As the dust dropped out of the air, they saw the reception area packed with cardboard mattresses, some feebly burning. Scorch marks blackened the walls. About half the torches in the room were still lit. The rest had been blown out. There were three dead Haldane fighters on the far side of the garrison's communal bedroom. Caught from behind by the Gren blasts, they all lay facing a hallway that led deeper into the building. Malosh stepped in front of the bullet-riddled information desk. He gestured toward the deserted hallway. It was about 12 feet wide, and there were three closed doors on each side. In the dim torchlight, Ryan could see there was another door facing them at the end of the corridor.
Clear every room in the hall!
Instead of doing the job themselves, the officers pushed some of the Norms in front of them. The conscripted clearing team included Ryan, Mildred, and JB. Ryan noted the hinges were on the hallway side, so the doors opened out. Ryan checked the first door. JB darted into the room, his Uzi ready to rip. Mildred entered after him. The windowless room was empty. From the shelves that lined the walls, it had once been used for storage. Some of the shelves had been tipped over onto the floor by the explosions. The companions moved back into the hallway. The second door on their side hid a utility closet, also bare to the walls. Either the garrison had no supplies, which was unlikely, or they had moved them all somewhere else in the Welcome Center. The three Norms checking the other side of the corridor weren't working so efficiently as the companions. They had only checked one door on the right, as Ryan, Mildred, and JB cleared their last room.
All clear on the left.
Clear!
Two men were hurled away from the doorway in a flash of light. Above the crumpled men, a line of ball bearings studded the bloody sheetrock.
Shit! Claymore mine! The bastards booby-trapped the red-blasted hall!
15 feet away, the door at the end of the corridor suddenly swung inward. Mildred opened fire. Under the horrendous close-range fusillade, the bottom half of the hollow core door turned to splinters. It continued to swing open for another 20 degrees of arc, then stopped abruptly. Ryan could see at least two prostrate bodies on the other side. He booted it all the way open. There were actually three, heaped on a landing at the top of a flight of stairs leading down.
Check that last door on the right.
Clear.
Good. Out of the way.
The companion stepped clear, letting the masked man move on to the landing.
Drag these bodies out of here.
By the time they were done clearing the landing, the officers had moved the entire Norm force into the hallway.
Haldane's men are holed up in the basement. We gotta clean them out.
The fearless Baron was the first down the stairs. Ryan was fourth. JB and Mildred were the fifth and sixth, respectively. In the flickering torchlight, Ryan counted 10 metal-edged steps before they came to another landing. Then the stairs turned at a right angle and descended again. The ceiling of the Welcome Center's basement was covered with pipes and ducts of all sizes, strung with cobwebs. A polished concrete floor reflected the light of dozens of wall-mounted torches. The wide room was furnished with machines inoperative since nuke day. Electric power, water pumps, air conditioning, furnace, some obviously plundered for scrap. All the torches hung along the right-hand concrete block wall. The row of lights pointed the way to another corridor entrance. At its end were two doors, sheathed in heavy steel plate. Only these had gun ports at waist height. Ryan could see a gun muzzle poking from each, leaving little doubt where the bulk of the Haldane force lay.
Put out the torches you can reach. All right. Make it to those doors and push Grenz through the firing ports.
The fighter captain didn't argue about the feasibility of the mission. In the weak light, he accepted some grins from an officer, then addressed his motley crew.
All right, people. It's up to us to finish this. First, we're going to put out the rest of the torches. If they can't see us, they can't hit us. Then we knock the bastards out.
Ryan had a hard time understanding the man's enthusiasm for the job he'd been handed. Maybe he was tired of living life as a cripple. The one-armed captain counted off a dozen of the fodder, then led them in a mad rush to the mouth of the hallway. Haldane's machine gunners let them get just inside the entrance of the 12-foot-wide corridor. Ferdinando took a burst through the chest as he reached for a torch. He went down hard. Somehow, the other sponges managed to put out all but two of the torches nearest the doors. In the process, all 12 were killed. Malash turned to an officer.
Go back to the entrance. Get the swampies to drag down one of those steel plates.
It took a while for the muties to accomplish that. The Impaler picked out a hefty-looking Norm, then selected JB and Ryan.
Use the plate as a shield. It's plenty thick enough to stop their bullets. Carry it in front of you to the end of the hall. Angle it so one of you can plant a satchel charge against the doors, set the fuse, then back out.
The trio tried to raise the 4x8 sheet of armor plate from the floor. Armor of sufficient thickness and temper to deflect heavy-duty bullets wasn't light. The thing weighed more than 300 pounds. If it was awkward to lift, it was even harder to carry. Ricochets sprayed the ceiling and shot back into the steel floors. Under the concentrated bullet impacts, the armor plate started to heat up. They inched forward for 5 more yards, then hit an obstacle. Fodder bodies were in the way. They had to lift the bottom of the plate over the corpses to get past. Ryan, JB, and the hefty Norm turned the plate at a 45-degree angle to the doors and advanced closer, shoving one end against the edge of the left-hand door. Working behind the low cover, which was supported by JB and the hefty Norm, Ryan quickly planted and primed the satchel charge. There was no room for error as they retraced their steps. They had to move quickly, but if they let the plate slip, they'd be chopped down. Pulling the plate turned out to be much more difficult than pushing it, especially when they had to accommodate the corpses on the floor. The way they were hustling, Ryan thought they could just clear the short hallway before the bag blew. He was wrong. Ryan came to as a crushing weight was lifted off his chest. He looked up to see Mildred leaning over him, with concern on her face.
Ryan, you okay?
The woman's lips moved, but Ryan's ears were ringing so badly he couldn't hear what she was saying. Beside him, JB was sitting up, shaking his head as he tried to clear it. His glasses and fedora were coated with fine white dust. The hefty Norm hadn't been so lucky. Looking around, Ryan saw that the doors to Haldane's underground stronghold were bucked and bent inward. Only smoke and dust came out of them.
Let's go, boys.
Leaning on Mildred for support, Ryan and JB moved away from the breached entrance. If there were any Haldane defenders who wanted to surrender, the Baron didn't give them the chance. He wasn't known as Malash the Merciful. At his signal, his men tossed handfuls of Grens through the torn-apart doors into the smoke. Malash and his fighters waited until all the smoke cleared before they moved into the room. This gave Ryan and JB enough time to recover their hearing. The three companions followed the other Norms over the threshold into an abattoir. The cellar room was littered with bodies and severed body parts belonging to at least 50 men. The walls and ceiling were decorated in a two-tone palette of black scorch and red gore. The Haldane garrison was history. Ryan, JB, and Mildred joined the troops pouring out of the welcome center. The battle was over. Sunspot had fallen to Malash. The companions didn't share the fighters' jubilation. Their only concern was finding their missing friends and doing it as quickly as possible, which turned out to be much simpler than any of them had anticipated. As they stepped away from the building, JB pointed toward the Vill's residential area.
Looky there!
Ryan stared at the mass of Vill folk that suddenly popped out from between the shanty lanes and started heading for the welcome center. Then he saw a trio of familiar faces. Christy, Jack, and Doc walked across the devastated compound toward them. All under their own power and seemingly in good health. All still armed. Ryan felt a wave of profound relief. In truth, he had been a lot more worried about them than he had let on to Mildred and JB. The tall, smiling redhead came into Ryan's arms, and he embraced her for a long moment. Baron Malash was celebrating his big win by riding his horse around the inside perimeter of the berm, shooting his twin AKs in the air.
Masked asshole.
Ryan checked the gate exits and saw that the victory lap hadn't been the Baron's first act. Malash had already assigned a number of armed guards to the exits, so the conscripts couldn't desert. The only way out of Sunspot appeared to be climbing over the berm, which in broad daylight would draw attention and bullets.
Are you all right, Doc?
I am perfectly fine, my dear Dr. Wyeth.
Ryan noticed a blonde Vill woman standing behind the time traveler. Her expression changed when Mildred touched Doc. It went from friendly to irritated in a split second. Ryan also noted her strange, beautiful, violet-colored eyes. In the middle of the compound, the Swampies were looting the bodies of foes and friends alike. As they gathered up dropped weapons and ammo, they rifled the pockets of the dead, looking for small, easily concealable items of value. Other muties and the surviving cannon fodder were cleaning up the welcome center. It appeared that Malash intended on reoccupying it as soon as possible. The limp bodies of the Haldane defenders were lugged out by their hands and feet. The body parts were carried piled on tarps. The human litter of battle was dumped in the middle of the compound, waiting either cremation or burial. Some of the muties started a bonfire to burn up the cardboard mattresses and bloody rags.
Dear friends, I would like you to meet Isabel. She is the leader of Sunspotville.
The companions nodded to Isabel.
Isabel and the Vill folk are planning to hit Malash.
You'll never beat him. He's got too many troops. It'd be suicide to even try.
Isabel put a hand on Doc's arm and looked into Mildred's eyes. A proprietary hand, it seemed to Ryan.
We plan to wait until Malash and most of his soldiers leave for the attack on Nuevaville. The odds are in our favor then.
Timing is everything.
You might be able to win a temporary victory against a reduced Malash force. But what do you really gain in the long run? Can you hold the Ville when Malash comes back, pissed off as hell with the rest of his fighters? Can you hold it when Haldane comes back? One or the other of them will crush you. That's guaranteed.
We've been caching arms and ammunition for months now. We intend to use it at the very first opportunity. We don't have any choice anymore. We have to fight. These bastard barons are grinding us into the dust.
Either way, you're going to die.
If you had to choose a way to go, would you take starvation or a bullet?
I see your point.
You could leave. You are most welcome to come along with us. Deathlands is an immense place. Its settlements are widely separated. It's easy to evade pursuit in the hellscape. All that's required is a week or two of non-stop walking. It's also easy to start another life somewhere new, somewhere better.
I won't desert my people, and we can't all come with you. The Barons want us here, as their field hands. If we try to run, they'll just hunt us down and drag us back. The fight is here.
Perhaps we could join you then.
You have no stake in this. Sunspot's Arvil. We've bought it with our blood and sweat and lives.
Munify! Hey! Everybody, come up here! You gotta see this! Munify!
All of Baron Malash's fighters, save those manning the wagon foot gates, surged for the Vill's gorge-facing wall.
Might as well have a look-see.
Standing on the crest of the barrier, Ryan looked down on the gorge and the blown-up section of Interstate 10. Immediately, he saw movement in the canyon bottom. Rapid movement. In the clouds of raised dust, something large and dark was frantically running and jumping in great bounds. It appeared to have too many legs by at least a couple of pair.
What the hell is that?
We call it the Gravedigger.
In point of fact, that creature is more of an exhumer. I came across it on my way up here last night. Although I couldn't see it clearly in the dark. From the evidence along the highway, it appears to feed upon the bodies buried in the gorge. Hence the name Gravedigger.
Mildred was amazed by the mutie's two seemingly contradictory attributes. The shaggy monster was incredibly fast and spry. It made consecutive 20-foot standing broad jumps, yet it was very large. She could only estimate its size in relation to other objects in the gorge, the width of the four-lane interstate, the bodies of the fallen fodder. From this, she guessed it was at least 8 feet across the body. It had very long, jointed legs. By straightening them, it could raise its belly 6 feet from the ground. Despite its size, it had to be very light. Otherwise, it couldn't have propelled its mass over such extreme distances and with such alacrity. It leapt atop a block of concrete, and for a second they could all see it in more detail.
Where's its head?
It was true. There was no head in evidence. The hairy body appeared to be nearly circular, and the four sets of legs allowed it to jump in any direction and hit the ground running.
It could be a tranny, transgenic bioweapon.
Trannies were living beings constructed from a mishmash of other species' genetics. It was yet another example of the lunacy and arrogance of pre-dark scientists. They had mixed snippets of DNA from different, naturally occurring species to produce new and unique living creatures for specific functional and research purposes.
It eats the wounded, too. It prefers not to fight for its dinner. It showed up down there about a year ago. Nobody knows where it came from, but there's only the one of them as far as we can tell. It only feeds at night. We've never seen it after sunrise. When there's fighting and dying, it's always hanging around. It stays hidden during the day. Something's chased it out of its hidey hole.
Because of the distance, the terrain, the speed, and the dust, it was difficult for Mildred to see exactly what that something was. Although she could tell there were lots of them, and they were much, much smaller than the thing they were chasing. The soldiers were taking bets on which mutie would win the battle in the gorge. Baron Malash had joined the fun. He stood watching the show with his men. His expression was hidden by the leather mask he wore.
The little muties are baby skagworms. There are so many of them in this area that the sunspot folk have started eating them regularly. They taste rather like lobster with a hint of pork chop. I highly recommend them.
Mildred remembered the skagworms from previous encounters. They were an insectoid mutie species, possibly another flawed batch of trannies with a non-functioning death gene. They were almost unstoppable because of their speed, mobility, and armor plate. And they came factory-equipped with an insane and bottomless hunger. The Gravedigger darted about in the gorge bottom like it had eyes in the back or whatever passed for its head. Again and again, it avoided the relentless predators with prodigious bounds and blindingly quick reverses of direction. Even so, the odds weren't in its favor. As the great beast leapt over a water-filled trench, skagworms dashed up an overhanging tilted slab of concrete and jumped. When the Gravedigger landed, the worms came down on its back, biting. Whirling, the spider-like monster shook off two of the black shapes. It scraped off two more with death blows from its front legs. Then it jumped away before the rest of the pack could close in for the kill. The worms riding on its back attacked its rear pair of legs if they're joined with the body. The power of their transverse jaws was immediately evident. In seconds, they clipped those legs off cleanly, but in the process were thrown from the gravedigger's back. Creamy white fluid, perhaps blood, gushed from the still moving stumps. The digger still had six legs to run on, and wasn't noticeably slowed by the amputations. 20 or 30 worms were in hot pursuit. Shiny black in the sun, they looked like fat, stubby snakes as they slithered over the broken ground in its wake. Prey and predators splashed through pools and jumped over blocks of concrete. The worms showed no sign of real organization. They proceeded in straight lines over and through the obstacle course. Instead of trying to encircle or trap their prey, instead of trying to bring it down, the worms were content to tear off manageable-sized chunks for individual consumption. Both species ignored the fodder bodies at their feet. It was hard to discern whether the worms were fighting over control of the turf and its spoils, or whether they just considered the gravedigger dinner. If the larger mutie was trying to defend its claim on the sunspot body farm, the loss of its limbs changed its mind. It reversed course yet again, making for the relatively intact roadway leading out of the gorge. It picked up incredible speed on flatter ground. The legs were not even visible, they were moving so fast. The gravedigger quickly put distance between it and the low shapes in pursuit. It raced out of the mouth of the gorge, continued down the ruined highway, heading due west. As the distance increased between predator and prey, the horde of black specks gave up the chase. Their intended target left the interstate and disappeared over a rise in the desert scrub.
If the scag worms are trannies, what are they made of? Instead of being a simple cross between two divergent species, they're more like a genetic stew. Millipede and giant cockroach and rhinoceros beetle, unlike the scag worms that were probably protected in deeply buried, hard-sided redoubt labs, the creatures that had provided snips of its component DNA hadn't survived Nuke Day and the prolonged stresses of Skydark.
Because of her training in pre-dark science, Mildred understood full well the danger of invasive species. New life form, new attributes. Bad news for existing organisms.
Look, they're coming back. Manna from heaven.
Are you out of your mind? Don't you see what's happening here?
What's happening is that God has finally answered our prayers. We'll have plenty of food again.
How can you be so stupid?
Easy, Mildred.
Easy what? She sees the hand of God, and I see extermination for every living thing within 1,000 miles. What we're looking at is a force of nature that can't be anticipated or controlled. You won't be eating the bugs for long, lady. They'll be eating you. Look down there.
Back down on the field of death, the skagworms slithered into view. They began feeding at once. Not just on the bodies of the fodder, they also hunted down the living who hid among the rubble. But there was no way for anyone on the berm to render help. The fastest, the youngest of the fodder, ran from the blown-up section of interstate, trying to escape the gorge.
Doc, you say you ate skagworm flesh?
The old man heard the question, but didn't respond. Perhaps because he was too busy fighting to keep down his dinner.
It tasted like pork, huh? Maybe there's a simple explanation for that. It's called cannibalism, once removed.
As they watched, the deserters were chased down from behind and dragged to the ground. 5 to 10 worms set upon each victim, slashing great gashes in the torso, then disappearing head first into the wounds. The deserters' bodies jerked and flailed as they were tunneled and cored. The skagworms went in shiny black, but they emerged red and dripping.
Damn it to hell!
Mildred turned and half ran, half slid down the side of the berm. Gun in hand, she barged past the fighters standing next to the gorge's center gun post entrance. She speed crawled on hands and knees through the culvert into the front seat of the half-buried Cadillac Escalade. Seized by blind fury, Mildred yanked the charging handle of the post's M60, dropped the sights, and cut loose on the skagworms. She walked fire over the feeding muties, chewing up the rotten tarmac, blasting the worms to bits, shattering their carapaces. Finally, Mildred eased off on the M60's trigger, her head wreathed in gun smoke, spent brass piled around her feet. Her heart pounding, she realized that someone was behind her in the SUV.
You feel better now?
No, goddammit. No.